All right. So happy to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming a bit early. It does mean that we will get you out of here early, and those of you living on campus can have a little dinner tonight. Usually, there's no dinner, is there, on a Thursday night? I know. Now you can have a dinner. So it's a pleasure to be here. We have the event tonight, the LePage Entrepreneurship Forum, is in support of entrepreneurship and small businesses and family business, medium-sized business. And for whom is it named after? Françoise LePage, who always sits in the back. She doesn't want us to tell. But the LePage Forum is in her honor. Should we honor our founding dean, Françoise LePage? So the LePage Forum is part of the Borowski School of Business, of which all of you are members, offering undergraduate, graduate, executive education, entrepreneurship, and leadership programs that provide theoretical knowledge and practical skills that you need to launch and advance your business career. So we hope that you will transform yourself, that you will transform business, that will transform the world. And we have our faculty here today. I want to thank them for joining us tonight, some of you. Dr. Vafa, Dr. Leeds, Dr. Sub. Thank you for joining us. So the Françoise O. LePage Center for Global Innovation focuses on business education of future and current entrepreneurs as innovative leaders and managers of global change. And our school has really been founded on international business many decades ago, so we're thrilled to have a forum of this type to support our entrepreneurship efforts. We have a minor in entrepreneurship, and I would like to ask Dr. Masood. Here you go, Jacob. Dr. Masood is going to talk with you about the minor in entrepreneurship.
Hi, everybody. Who wants to live an amazing life? All right, let's see a show of hands. Well, guess what? Many entrepreneurs get to do just that. Successful entrepreneurs are able to shape their own destiny. They have the freedom to control the work that they want to do. And we are excited to offer a new minor in global innovation and entrepreneurship. And I'm going to talk to you for a few minutes about this opportunity. Now, this clip I'm going to show you is from a Kickstarter campaign for a product called Sentry. It's a hoodie that was designed by a student at University of Portland in Oregon. And I want you to see this because this could be you pursuing something that you're passionate about.
What if there is something that could perform like a rain jacket while fitting, looking, and feeling like your favorite sweatshirt, erasing the need to choose between comfort and function? Introducing...
I think it's cool. Hey, what can I say? They raised $50,000. They exceeded their target goal of $10,000, and they've had a successful launch selling products through sites such as Touch of Modern. So what does our minor look like? It consists of four courses. I've got some good news for you, though. Two of them are in our business core, marketing and entrepreneurship. So you are already going to take that, or you will have taken it already. So what does that leave? Just two courses, innovation and design thinking and global innovation practicum. Now, let me say a couple things here. This curriculum is going to give you an opportunity to be exposed to both industry and practice. You'll have a trip to a local incubation or entrepreneurial hub in Silicon Valley. In addition, for those of you that are successful, a business plan competition will award a $1,000 prize to the winning team. And then the program will culminate in a 10-day international business trip. And I've got exciting news in a few slides showing you where the destinations will be. So what are you going to take away from this? We think you are going to learn to bring an idea to market. You're going to learn to think outside the box, which is really important. You don't even have to become an entrepreneur. These skills are going to be valuable no matter what career you pursue. You're also going to build confidence throughout the entire program. One other thing that's important for entrepreneurs is the ability to network, and we're going to help you build your network. So where are you going? Europe. 10 days, Paris and Rome. Sounds pretty exciting, doesn't it? And I got even better news. The first 15 students that sign up will get a $1,000 scholarship. So that will defer part of the cost. Normally the cost of the trip is $3,000. For those 15 students, the trip cost will be $2,000. So there are some fees associated with this, but we want you to become a part of this great opportunity. And we're really excited to launch this minor as a part of the LePage Center. So thank you. And we look forward to you expressing your interest. Please talk to Daniel Cassidy during advising.
Who's interested? Let's raise those hands. I want to go too. Sounds good. Well, we have the wonderful opportunity to meet two CEOs, people who have been remarkable entrepreneurs through their careers. And then we have the chance to have our student leaders in the Borowski Student Association also do some interviewing of our guests as well. Will you have that chance? So why don't I ask both of you to come forward first, and while I introduce you, Kathy Tierney and Michael Volpott, could we please welcome them? So I've known Kathy for 25 years. Kathy, we're looking better, girl. We're looking better. And Kathy is an alumna of Dominican and was a trustee here and made a huge impact on our school as we were forming and developing and growing and moving from Dominican College to Dominican University. Kathy has a rich background in retail industry, international business, and travel. She has been the CEO of Sur La Table. Do any of you know that store? It's a high-end multi-channel purveyor of professional cookware for home chefs. She was in that role from 2004 through 2008, and then served on the board as an executive vice chairman from 2008 to 2011, so has this great experience both as CEO and at the board level. Before Sur La Table, she was an independent contractor, a consultant with a client list of places like Home Depot, Vinginkuri, and Yoga Works. And from 2001 through 2011, she was the CEO at Fitch North America, a global brand and design firm. So she has consulting experience as well. She was also the former CEO of Smith & Hawken, a Mill Valley company, a lawn and garden retail company, which was a major, major brand here in Marin County. I remember, Kathy, you said you started when there was 7 stores and you ended with 40, something like that. It was a really... Three stores.
Yeah. Right.
And they really grew under Kathy's leadership. Before that, she was with Nature Company, overseeing the growth from 3 locations to 120 stores nationwide. She's also a director of many boards, and she has she also has earned her degree here at Dominican, as I said. She also served 2 years at the Peace Corps, and she has received a strategic marketing certificate from Harvard University. She also loves to travel and trek. In between some of these executive roles, she's taken some time to go to Nepal and Bhutan and climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Please welcome Kathy Tierney.
Thank you, Denise.
You're welcome, Kathy. Mr. Volpott, Michael Volpott, is, I guess, a colleague of Kathy's.
Yeah, you're
going to talk about that?
Cool. I'm going to tell a story how we met. Because...
All right, great. Michael Volpott is a serial entrepreneur with businesses that span public relations, real estate, construction, food, and wine. The majority of his career has been in the world of PR for technology companies. 16 years ago, he founded a business with his partner. It's called Larkin Volpott Communications, and quickly seized both small and large companies as clients. They have worked in the digital divisions of Hearst Magazines and Publishing Clearinghouse, and for more than 100 startups. He and his partner have been diligent about saving cash and diversifying their investments. This strategy led to the opening of Big Bottom Market and investments in other businesses. Michael's entrepreneurial spirit is an important part of everything that he sets his sights upon, and rarely does he say no to a challenge. Please welcome Mr. Michael Volpat.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you.
So we're thrilled that you're here this evening, and what we'd like to ask you to do is perhaps take a seat if that makes you feel comfortable.
Okay.
And for about 20 minutes, we're going to have a conversation that we will observe between our two guests, and then after that, we'll have our interview portion.
Oh, boy. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm used to standing up, because remember, Denise, I'm supposed to call you Dr. Lucy, probably not.
Are you standing or sitting? Are we standing?
I was a teacher, too. Yeah. I started out as a teacher in the Peace Corps, and just loved teaching when I was in Fiji. Came back and tried it, and just didn't work for me. So I said, I'm going to get a job at the nature company. And I stayed there for 23 years, and then it led to all my other experiences, which I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight. But before I start, I just, you know, here we are. I'm retired. I was a CEO. I don't think of myself as an entrepreneur, but I worked with entrepreneurs. So I was a little bit nervous when they invited me to come and talk to you all. I go, I'm not an entrepreneur. What am I going to say? So I go, Michael, I know a real entrepreneur. And we became friends because we sat on a nonprofit board together called the River Keeper. And we were talking to each other on the way down here, and I said, you know, we looked across the room, and we went, I think this is the guy who I'm going to be friends with.
Fast friends,
and,
is what I like to say.
And we just both share the same interest in getting things done. We both believe in the environment. So ever since that day, I don't even know, maybe 10 years ago, we've been friends. And we help each other, even though we come from very different backgrounds. So before, this is a night of questions. We have questions. We're going to ask you questions. And we're going to answer questions. And then we're going to wrap up with some questions. But we wanted to ask you to think about three things right now. You don't have to give us the answers, but we're going to come back to these at the end. And the first one is, do you want to be an entrepreneur? Like Dr. Mossad said, it looks very attractive. It's fun. It's interesting. Do you want to do that?
Do I look attractive? Is that why you're pointing at me?
Yes. The second question is, have you figured out, if you want to be an entrepreneur, how are you going to figure out what you want to do? I love that. Sweatshirt, by the way, that is looks like something that would be really fun to own. And the third question is,
what do you really want to do with your professional career? And that's a big part of what entrepreneurship is all about. Is like, do I really want to do what I think I want to do, and what will it take to make that happen?
So we're going to come back to those questions at the end, and hopefully some of our comments and some of our answers to the questions that you all asked us will help you think a little bit deeper about it. But so you heard about my bio. I've had a very interesting career, I have to say. I never planned to become a CEO. I majored in English literature here. No business classes. Did not get an MBA, but I quickly was fortunate to get involved in a startup, and I was the fourth employee. And for 20 years, I stayed at the Nature Company and learned pretty much everything I know now. I learned a little bit after that, but when I was there, and this is really the value, I think, for you all, is I just raised my hand and would do anything. I started out running the mail order business. Then they said, hey, we're going to grow the retail stores. I go, I can do it. I had no idea how to do that. I was just so excited and so curious and so passionate, and I loved the company so much. And it went on for that way for many years. I ran the IT department. I bought our first computer. I didn't have any experience. And I guess what I'm trying to say to you is you have to be curious. You really have to be curious to be a successful business person. And raise your hand, put yourself out there, and you're going to hear this theme, I think, from both of us about, you know, the risks that you're going to have to take and the fears and some of the failures, all those things came with it. But I think the one thing, when I think back on that part of my career, and Denise, Dr. Lucy said, you know, I went there when we had 2 stores and I left when there were 120, and I opened all of them, all over the United States, in Japan, in Paris. So if you're curious, and if you are in the right place, and you like what you're doing, it leads very smoothly to the next step in your career. The next thing I did was, this is a great story. This is I'm going to talk a little bit about this when I'm answering questions, but I am a very passionate gardener. It is the thing I love the most, is gardening. And I was getting bored of, you know, working at the nature company, but I'd worked with them for so long. I went to the chairman of the board and I said, hey, you know me, you can trust me. You buy companies all the time. I want you to invest in me. I want to start a gardening business. And he said, great. And so I was putting together a business plan, which I had to like look up, you know, at the library on how to write a business plan. And the best brand in gardening at that time was Smith & Hawken, as Dr. Lucy had mentioned. It was right here in Mill Valley. And he called me up one day and he said, hey, how about I buy Smith & Hawken? And I was like, oh my, this is like the best thing that could ever happen, because I thought this is going to force us to go forward so quickly and really learn how to do this without having to build the business from the ground up. So I drove over to Mill Valley, and I was the president originally and then ended up being the CEO, and that was the best job of my life. I loved working there. And I have so many lessons I'm going to share with you during the questions, but for me, it really, the biggest lesson of all is, if you're doing something you love, if you're passionate about something, it's not work. It's just such fun to build a business on an idea that you love. The next thing, this is why we're going to talk about failure. So I thought about my time at Smith & Hawken. I was there for almost 7 years. I took a sabbatical at the end of the time, which I highly recommend. You take time off when you're out there working. And I had a lot of time to think, and I came back, and I thought, well, I really, really love branding and marketing. And I think I'll just go full time into that, because that's all I'll get. I'll have to do, and I won't have to do all this other stuff that I don't like to do. So that's when I went to Fitch, and it was a mistake. That was one of the worst jobs I ever had. All I got to do was go out and try to win work. Have you ever heard of Rainmaker? Well, that's what you get to do. You go out and you meet with clients, you win the work, then you pass it on to somebody else, and they do the work, and then you go out and win work again. And it was so unfulfilling to me. I never got my hands on anything, and I realized I really like being in operations. I like running businesses. And so I got out of that business very quickly. I think I was there maybe 2.5, 3 years, and went back into running Sur La Table, which was, again, such a wonderful opportunity that I was given. And I was given it because I was at Smith & Hawken, and I networked with some people there. They needed somebody to go up there, and they called me. We're going to talk a lot about networking as well. And so what did I really learn from all this stuff, besides the things I've told you? I think the biggest lessons for me were, do something you love. I mean, life is too short. Business has got so many opportunities now. And if you can find something, if there's something that you love, or you and your friend love, that's really the best place to start if you're an entrepreneur. The second thing is, it is very, very hard work. I once had a student, and he said, I just want to do something easy. You know, my uncle's in the insurance business, and he doesn't work very hard, so I want to be in the insurance business. That is not going to work. You have to be willing to put in the hard, long days. One of the things that I talk about is in a leadership class I teach about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, you are just pushed right to the max of your ability, physical abilities, because there's no oxygen. And so what do? You put one foot in front of the other for days on end. And the Swahili, the people in who are our guides, they always used to say pole pole, which means slow, slow. And I think when you're young, like you all are, and you are thinking about grabbing these opportunities, there's a real aspect to doing things that are hard outside of work, like run a marathon. Do something fabulous that is hard for you, because that just flows right over into your career. And I'll tell you, doing hard work is what you're going to do if you start a business or if you actually work in another entrepreneurial business. And the last thing, we talk a lot about this, and it's, you know, I was talking to a few students before about finance and, you know, money and accounting and all that, and that you have to study all that. But I have to tell you, it's the game you're going to sign up to play is to make money. Now, that sounds really attractive, I'm sure, because I'm sure you all want to make money. But you cannot take your eye off the ball when you start a business. When you're working in a business, you have to pay attention to the money. And Michael's going to talk more about that from an entrepreneurial point of view, because he has to go out and raise money a lot of times to support his business. I always worked in companies where, you know, we had funding and we had private equity money and we had different kinds of money. But it's so important that you like to have a bottom line that reflects the hard work. So many people that I've met are passionate and they love it, but they are really not interested in the money part. And as I don't know what the right word is, but it's so important that you embrace the concept of doing something you love to make money, because that is what business is about. That's the scorecard. That's the report card. I always used to tell my teams, you know, until we really can prove that we can really run this business and be profitable, we're not successful. So now I'm going to let Michael, the last lesson that I learned, and we'll talk more about this in the questions, is you got to be willing to embrace change. How many of you like change? Good. Because that will stand you well. I actually like change, too. I'm sort of one of those weird people that things aren't changing, I make them change. But, you know, you're sitting here at this beautiful young age thinking about your careers. For some of you, they're sooner than others. And you don't know what's going to come at you. And so many things change from when you start a business to when you end up in a business. And you've got to be willing to do that. You've got to be willing to say, okay, that didn't work out. I think I will start to change. Change happens externally to you, and change happens internally to you. And you have to be comfortable with both of them. So those are sort of my initial lessons. We're going to talk about more examples as we go through the other questions. And now I'm going to turn it over to the real entrepreneur, Michael.
Thank you. Yep, I have mine. I want to start out by saying, I was so fortunate to meet Kathy when we met. I say to people all the time, one of the most important things you can do as a professional, as an entrepreneur, is to find a mentor. Find somebody who's been there and done that and really has a lot of knowledge. I find myself turning to Kathy all the time and asking her questions, coming into my market and talking about how we're setting up retail to sell more. So one of the big things that I would always recommend is that you find yourself a mentor. And I was very lucky at a young age to have a mentor. It was my dad. My dad's an entrepreneur. After working for a company for 40 years, being super loyal, they fired him. Fired. So he came home and he said, I'm gonna do things on my own. He started his own construction company, and that kind of launched our family into the construction business. And I had to work at that construction company to realize, I don't wanna be in construction, Dad. I have no interest whatsoever. You know, I spent a summer carrying concrete forms and working on jobs as a laborer, and it just wasn't fun to me. So I had to do a lot of things to learn what I didn't want to do. So that's important for you to remember. You know, you got to take any job that somebody's going to hand to you, and you just have to do it. You have to be willing to do just about anything so you can realize, you know what, that's not really right for me, so I'm going to move in this other direction and work on that. So I worked for a while for corporations out of college, and it was great. I learned a lot. I cut my teeth on other people's lessons that they were teaching me, and that was really important. I worked for a large sausage company called Bob Evans Farms on the East Coast. And then I went to work for ad agencies, and in working for these ad agencies, I got to work on other clients and learn quite a bit about marketing and public relations. But I wasn't happy. I was not happy working for somebody else. I don't like people to tell me what to do. I want to do what I want to do, and I want to do it the way that I want to do it. And so my father pulled me aside, and he said, I worked for 40 years for people I didn't want to work for. I don't want you to go through that same thing that I did and figure out at the age of 50 that you're going to start your own company, where there's nothing wrong with starting your own company at the age of 50, but what he was trying to tell me was, I want you to do it now. And he inspired me. So I wrote a business plan, and I quit my job. I was living in New York City at the time. I think my rent was like $4,000 a month, which is crazy. And I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to pay the bills? I am so scared. And I had to be scared, because if I wasn't scared, I wouldn't have gone out and gotten a bunch of clients. I wouldn't have turned to the person sitting next to me at a bar who I'd never met before and start talking to this woman who 17 years later is my business partner. We just started chatting and realized that we were really into the same things. And I was working on a project and I needed help. And all of a sudden, there we were in business together. It was fascinating. It really, really taught me that one of the most important skills that you can have, and this is one of my big lessons, is networking. And I always say, talk to everybody. Anyone that will listen to you, anyone that will answer a question, anyone that you want to listen to those people. Always be open to networking, because it's of the utmost importance. I would not be where I am today without it. I think one of my best networking stories is with Big Bottom Market. We had a pop-up in New York City, and I had worked with Hearst Magazines, I think she said that. We worked with Hearst Magazines Digital, doing all of their public relations work. And we had this pop-up in New York, and Cosmopolitan had just written an article about vacationing in Guerneville, and I thought, I'm gonna take biscuits to Hearst Magazines, because we're known for our biscuits at Big Bottom Market. So I thought, great, I'm gonna go say thank you. And I went to a person that I know at Hearst, somebody I met through networking, and I said, will you introduce me to the team at Cosmo so I can take them biscuits? And she said, yes, I'm gonna introduce you to them, but I'm also gonna introduce you to Oprah's people. And they took me down to Oprah's offices, and I didn't meet Oprah, but I met Oprah's creative director, and he tasted my biscuits. And he said, do you sell these nationwide? And I went, yes. We didn't sell them nationwide. So I faked it until I make it. So about 4 weeks later, he called me to tell us that we were gonna be one of Oprah's favorite things. Oh my God, this was 2016. We weren't selling our mix nationwide. We didn't have our honey producer was a woman, I think in Berkeley, with four hives. We needed 8,000 jars of honey and 8,000 bags of mix. And I just had to figure it out, and we did. And today, our honey and our mix are sold nationally in grocery stores everywhere. So without networking and knowing the right people, I would have never kind of followed that path where, oh my gosh, I got to meet Oprah's people, and oh my gosh, now we're one of Oprah's favorite things. That's why networking is absolutely important. You know, the next thing I want to talk about is storytelling. I do this in my job as a PR person all the time. We help people tell their stories, because if you can't tell your story clearly and concisely, no one's gonna listen. There's too much noise in the world these days. So we have this process we call the 4 Ds: different, defensible, disruptive, and direct. What makes you different, your idea? How are you gonna defend the differentiation that you're claiming you have? What's disruptive about what you're doing? And how are you gonna say that in the most direct way? If you can articulate those three things in a very direct way, then people are going to listen. Investors are going to listen. And that's the third big lesson that I have for you, is that Investors invest in people. So if you're a person that can tell your story in a very clear and concise way, they're going to listen to you. They invest in ideas too, and getting money is a really hard thing. So you have to stand out. You also have to be willing to pivot. Not every idea is the best idea. Your idea is not the best idea. So you have to be willing to listen to other people around you who know better. I always like to say, let the people that know better know better. Listen to those people and be willing to turn a different direction and pivot your idea and follow the people that know better. That's kind of my mantra on a daily basis when running the businesses that I have been so fortunate to be a part of. So I think at this point, Kathy, do we ask Adrian to come up on stage?
Aiden, yeah.
Aiden, sorry.
That was great. Well,
thank you. Well, thank you, Kathy and Michael, for some very amazing insights into entrepreneurship and creating your own way. Right now, I'm going to just give a brief oversight of what BSA does. I'm the president of BSA. It's right there. But we offer a lot of student, where we offer students professional development experiences, and we offer them to alumni as well as they pursue careers about which they're passionate. And there we have a picture from last year of the group. And I just quickly wanted to invite all of you to our meetings. They're every Thursday, sets from 8:15 to 9 p.m. in ILS. And then now I will invite up our other panelists, Dylan Finley, Marissa Vang, Olga Cullen. They're all your peers, and we're gonna enjoy the conversation we have with Michael and Kathy. So coming up, guys.
So I'll be starting with the first question. Kathy and Michael, what is the greatest challenge when starting a business in general?
You need to answer that one because I have never, I started some things, but it's not my story.
There's a couple of things that are really, can be challenging, but also can be rewarding. The first one is funding. You always think you have enough money, and you never do. You never have enough. And so you have to be really careful about the way you spend money. When we were building out Big Bottom Market as a retail business, it was like we had the deepest pockets ever. And then the doors opened, and we thought, oh, we have to pay people. And the customers weren't coming in as fast as we were convinced they would. And so we had to get more funding. And that was really hard to go to people and say, I messed up, I didn't realize how much money we needed, and we need more. Which meant then that we had to service debt. And I hate those two words in the same sentence. Servicing debt is not fun. It's money that basically goes into other people's pockets and not your own. So if you can manage your money when you're starting up and avoid taking loans and servicing debt, then you're gonna be in a really good place. The next thing that is a challenge is partnerships. It's really hard to go it alone. You can do it, but for me, we looked to partners. And my first partner in business, who is still my partner to this day that I met in that bar on that night after I quit my job, she and I have gotten along really well, and we've gotten along well because we divide and conquer. And, you know, I say, let the people that know better know better. She knows better about some things, and I know better about other things. And so we tackle those things and come to each other when we need each other. So that's really important. We had another partner we didn't get along with very well. And so we had to find a way to shake that partner. And that wasn't easy either. Partnerships don't always go down this sunny road. Sometimes there are challenges associated with partnerships. You don't agree, or one person wants to do everything and doesn't let the people that know better know better. I say it again and again. So that's really, those are two for me the biggest challenges when starting a business.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an entrepreneur in the true sense of like Michael is, but I've worked for businesses and where I was hired to create things. And when I went to Smith & Hawken, I always say they had three stores, Mama Bear, Baby Bear, and Papa Bear, and none of them were right. One was too big, one was too little, and one was in a situation that was absolutely not replicable in any way. So my biggest challenge there was creating a model that we could open around the United States in different places. And the first store I opened was in Los Gatos. It was like birthing a baby. It was so wonderful and exciting, except we spent way too much money on it. Way too much money. And my boss came and he goes, that is not okay. And so I did have a boss that made me manage money, but we had to go back and we had to cut out a lot of the things that we thought were such good ideas to really get a business or a model of a store that we could then open, you know, over and over again. So it's kind of the same thing Michael's saying. If you don't know how to manage money and funding, the growth stops. The growth will stop very quickly. And that's really, besides making money, growth is kind of what we all sign up for, I think.
Thank you so much for your answers. My next question would be for Kathy. What are the differences between being an entrepreneur inside a company and becoming an entrepreneur of your own firm?
Yeah, I think you probably could answer this for me because of all the comments we've said. But number one, when you're working in a fully funded venture, like all the ones I've done have had either private equity money or they've been privately financed by somebody. So I didn't have to go out and raise money. I did have to manage money. So I think there's a security that you have when you're working for someone else. You get a salary every month. If Michael doesn't sell a lot of biscuits, he doesn't get paid. So there's a real difference between your comfort with risk and your comfort with knowing what's going to happen. There's a lot of the same skills you need to manage that. I think the second thing is, and I used to hire people like Michael, because I always wanted to bring in talent and find really creative people. And so you'd have somebody who had worked for themselves, and they'd been making lots of decisions, and then you bring them into this company, and it's very collaborative. You hardly ever get to make a decision that you don't either have to sell to somebody or work with somebody to make it happen. So I think like Michael said, he doesn't ever want to work for somebody. That is a path that is recommended if you like that. I really like teamwork and team building and hiring and doing all those things that you guys are learning how to do. So working for other people always worked better for me. I think the other thing is speed. Speed to market. I mean, Michael could do that. I mean, how many weeks did you spend on getting the biscuits? You were moving at the speed of light. Because you're in a motorboat.
Yeah.
You can move quick. We were in the Queen Mary. You want to turn, you got to tell everybody. You got to get your boss. You got to get the board. You got to get the team. You've got to get everybody moving the same direction. And you either like that or you don't. I actually like working with other people. I love watching everybody be successful at something that we've agreed to do, but it's not fast. It takes time to really convince people, the teams, all the teams. We were talking just about being the president of a university and how hard that is to try to get everybody aligned around an idea. So I think that's one big distinction. I think you have to check in with your own personality and say, am I more like Michael? Do I not want a boss? Or do you want to have a team? And do you want to work with other people? And I think there's a huge distinction.
Great, thank you. So when we talk about growth specifically as an entrepreneur, and when we're talking about building your business, how do you manage growth, especially hyper fast growth?
You want to talk first?
Yeah, I think the I'll go back to the Oprah example. That was a fast track, and we managed it just by facing it head on. You know, we didn't have a choice. It was you either do it, get it done, and use these 6 weeks to make a lot of money and then figure out what the strategy is going to be afterward for continuing that growth, or you just don't do anything. So what we did initially was sit down and strategize and say, how are we going to make the next 6 weeks of this growth really, really pan out for us in a way that will set us up so that after these 6 weeks are over, we can then decide, how are we going to move forward from here? And so you kind of have to take growth, you have to think about it strategically, you have to face it head on, and you have to continually be willing to pivot and change as the growth is happening, because it literally changes at the speed of light.
Yeah, and I love growth. If I was going to write a book, it would be on how to grow a business, but somebody already wrote that. Paul Hawken. So I'm going to use Sur La Table as an example, because I went up there. They'd been in business for 10 years. They had never made any money. They had new investors who were quite serious about making money, and they hired me. And so I went into this business, and I just observed for not long, because I could tell that there was a lot of changes that I was going to have to make. And the number one is the talent, is the people. I inherited 11 direct reports, and I kept 3 of them. Now, that's not the fun part about business, but it's a real part. You've got to be willing to face difficult situations, and there's nothing more difficult than terminating somebody, but you have to do it. Second thing is I sat down with a very small group of people who I thought knew the brand best, and I wrote the clearest, and I could show it to you today, and you would understand Sur La Table very well. I wrote the clearest document, and it was what we used. Nobody veered off of it. It had our strategy, our vision, our mission, all the external competition, and it was probably, I don't know, it wasn't that long, maybe 10, 12 pages. But we never stopped communicating that vision and that document to everybody. So I would meet with the new employees. As soon as they'd come in, I'd sit down with them, I'd show it to them, and I'd answer questions. We would talk about it constantly. So you really need a map to grow. It's just like if you jump in your car and you say, oh, where are we going? I don't know. Well, if you don't know where you're going, it doesn't really matter. But I was trying to, number one, make the company profitable, and number two, open a lot of stores. And we opened like hundreds, but not until we were ready. I actually stopped growth when I went there. I stopped opening stores. I said, we're not going to do this. We're not ready. So once we got ready, we got the people, we had our map of how we were going to do it. It was fun.
So I'm going to touch on that because you did mention your stores. So I'm wondering, since you are an expert in the field of retail, can you tell me what your thoughts are about the future of brick and mortar companies in the future?
I can't see around corners, but I do read a lot. I do talk a lot, and I sit on lots of different boards. And I would say this is probably the toughest time for retail right now. You know, it's the Amazon effect. And I mean, they are so good at what they do. I mean, they're terrifying to compete with on every level. But I do think retail has a future. And it's almost putting entrepreneurship back into the model, because I think that the businesses that really are succeeding now are the ones that are doing something completely different. And I'm working on a business right now in Chinatown, and it's called China Live. And it combines a restaurant with a retail store and an event center. And so I think these new ideas that combine, you know, a cafe. I mean, some business just opened a cafe in the middle of their store in New York.
Uniqlo.
You know, you really have to be entrepreneurial with retail right now to try to figure out how to do something different. And there is great retail out there. It's just mostly not in the United States. I mean, I go to Europe, and I am just salivating over the stuff that's going on there. And I think they're just more entrepreneurial. They're not afraid to try new things. So I think that, and I think the last thing, which is a sort of a business model thing that you guys will probably study, is multi-channel. Do you know what multi-channel means? Yeah, multi-channel means you're not in just retail. You're in e-commerce. You're in retail. We had cooking, we had a cooking business at Cerro La Tabla where people could come and learn how to cook. So you've got to spread yourself around and be different. And I think it's, then you can do something different. It has to be unique. It has to be something that people haven't seen before. You know, the malls, they're all dying because they're so ubiquitous. You could be in Maine or you could be in San Diego and they look the same. They have the same stores. They're just so boring. So people who are surviving and I think thriving right now are doing something that's really different and interesting. And there's real good examples out there, I think. But I think you cannot be in business without being on the web. It's not possible. You have to have a web component now.
Well, I have to tell you, I hope malls never go away. But that's just me.
There are some good ones, but there are some really boring ones as well.
Well, let me jump in real quick and just say that it's all about creating an experience. And we have tried really hard to create a unique experience at Big Bottom Market. We picked a we picked something that we were going to be really good at, which is the biscuit. And we created a story around the biscuit. And everyone comes in, and the line goes around, out the door, and you know, around this table. And people are coming there because it's like they're at Mecca. You know, and not only is the biscuit delicious, but Oprah said it was delicious. So creating that experience for people is really important. And you see that in like, I forget what that mall's called in LA, where everything's outside. And not only do they have stores, but they have these great restaurants and bars and things to do. So experiences are really important. Everyone's talking about experiential marketing these days, and it works. And you see it working on things like Instagram. These influencers are like, look at this great experience I'm having. That's what everyone is drawn to, experiences.
Yeah, I have to brag about Michael's Big Bottom Market. You guys can go visit, by the way. It's in Guerneville. It's an hour from here.
Yeah.
Maybe not even. Yeah, hour. One of the things he's done really well is integrate his own value system, which is environmental, and that's how, because I'm a total environmentalist. And I think he does things like work with the Sonoma Land Trust. And, you know, obviously the Riverkeeper where we worked and does so much good for the community. I call him the mayor of Guerneville. And he's done that intentionally to build this brand and this experience. So it's very different than just going in and getting a cup of coffee. And there is the biscuits as well.
Yeah, man, it's also what I love. So we talked about do what you love to do. I love sharing. And if I can share as part of the business that I own, that makes me an even happier person. It makes going to work every day a lot more fun because people appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
It's funny that you actually bring up the value that we did, because in Dr. Lucy's class for freshman EWB, we actually just found what our values are, and she encourages us to sort of build up on that and work with our values with whatever business that we choose to work for or start up. So thank you for that. And this question is for both of you. It's kind of a two-part question. Do you remember some of the fears you had, and what was the biggest takeaway that you had from that experience?
Let me go first. So I think I told you how I was so passionate about gardening, and Smith and Hawken was like, it was like Mecca. I mean, honestly, it was the best possible expression of a garden business. They had national recognition. It was just a beautiful place to be. The products were the highest quality. I mean, this is how long ago it was. I actually could say to our buyers, you may not buy anything in China, and they didn't. Everything was from France or England. Those days are over. But I was so in awe of it, and it was the first time I was a CEO, which I think that's the hardest thing, the first time. I did not make the changes I needed to make for months. And finally, I went to the mountain and I said, it's time. I've got to take control of this brand, because it was sort of like a cult. People did what they wanted to do. There was very little discipline. Nobody cared about making money. And I called it my looking for love in all the wrong places speech. And I'll never forget, I went and I got everybody sitting down and I said, this is it. This is a business. This is a great business.
and you can be a part of this business, but these are the rules. This is how we're gonna behave, this is what we're gonna do, and we're gonna have fun doing it, but we are going to do it together and make money. And the days of wandering in here at noon, I mean, it was everybody, I mean, I know bringing dogs to work has a lot of attraction to people, but we had a pack of dogs at work. I mean, dogs are pack animals, if you don't know, and we had like 12 of them. I go, the dog people, go in that room and figure it out. We're not having this craziness. We had to spray the office every month for fleas, and one time they were having a big dog war outside my, and I was on a board call, and I go, that's it, no more, stop it. So I think my lesson is that I just was afraid to make any changes. I was just terrified of really putting down the things that I knew in my gut had to be done, and I did them. It was the best job. I told you I loved it. We put together a great team, and we had fun after that, and we made money.
I was really afraid when we bought our business partner out of Big Bottom Market. I had never owned a restaurant before, and we had been in business with her for 5 years, and we weren't profitable, and we were spending a lot of money to buy this person out, and my business partner is on the East Coast, so I was the man. It was going to be me. I had to figure this out. I had to write this unprofitable ship into profitable waters, and it was scary, and I didn't know how to do it, and so I turned to math. Look at you two, because we talked about finance. And I started looking at the numbers, and I was like, oh, the numbers don't make any sense. What can we do to have these numbers make sense? And that started to take my fear away and make me realize I can't actually do this. I can do this. I've done so many things in my life. I can figure out these numbers and I can make this work. So we focused on margin, we focused on finding money, and my fear went away. So I think it's important to understand what fears are, but then figure out how you're gonna make those fears go away. How are we gonna face them head on? You know, this was, we faced the Oprah thing head on, we made it happen, now here I am faced with all these numbers, and I'm not good at math. Thank God for calculators. So I was able to figure out the numbers and really start to make the business profitable again.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think one of the, I'm not that great at math either. The first person I always hire is a CFO. But business is fifth grade math. It's all percentages. It's just percentages. It's what you know how to do. So for those of you who are not mathematically inclined, there's probably some people in the audience who are, hire them. Because they will do all the finance and P&Ls and balance sheets and stuff, but you can figure out the real mathematical decisions are all about percentages, like margins. Yeah. How much are you paying?
A number of margin calculators,
right,
online.
How much are you paying and how much are you charging? It's a pretty simple calculation. How much are you paying for salaries? It's always a percent, you know? You try to aim for maybe 10% of your sales to spend on staffing. It's not hard. That part, I would say, is easy, but you do need a CFO, too.
So taking a step away from our fears and about math, being a CEO and being a founder of a company and an organization, a business, how's your vision for your company, or while you were at Sur La Table, for your company kind of deferred? Let's say like from your time at Smith & Hawken, going on to Sur La Table, and then for you, Michael, kind of jumping from your cereal businesses, yeah.
How does it change from business to business? Mm-hmm. I actually think it changes in that each brand is different, but it doesn't change because I personally have a core set of values that I take into every business that I start. And number one core value, and I learned this from working for bosses that I did not like, is I want to be treated a certain way, and I think people need to be treated that way as well. I will only do to others as I would do to myself. So that's my first core value. My second one is community and giving back to the community. I don't wanna, when I step into a community, I own that community, and I try to get to know everything about that community and make my business part of what that community is all about. So those two core values are really important, treating people with respect and embracing the people around you, because at the end of the day, they're your customers, so.
Yeah, and I have a different, very different example. So Smith & Hawken was one of the most environmentally correct places I've ever worked. I mean, it was founded on in Mill Valley on environmental principles. I mean, I'd say that was probably one of the pillars of the company. So I was born in Berkeley. I mean, I've been an environmentalist since I was born. My mom was an environmentalist. So off I go to Sur La Table after I've worked at Smith & Hawken, and we're doing this value. I've got this small group of people together. We're trying to create this whole vision statement and all these values. And they're talking about, you know, all the things they believe, quality, you know, education, all these wonderful words. And the environment never came up. And so I went and said, well, what about the environment? And they go, what are you talking about? We don't care about that. And so I had to set aside my personal values. I ultimately changed it, but not immediately, because it wasn't important to me to have it, the imprint of my values on that company. What was important to me was to make the company successful. So somewhere down the road, 5 or 6 years, I was able to come back, and it was a much more accepted concept that, you know, businesses have to be responsible stewards of the planet. And I think the thing that I always hope comes true with making money, and I think this is Michael's talking about it at a small level, but at a large level, if you do well, you can do good. So we go back to that loop. You've got to have a profitable business, then you can do what you want. And we ended up partnering with Feeding America and let people take a day off and go out and volunteer, because that was a food business and we were a kitchen business. So you marry those two things together so that they make sense to the employees. You don't just come in there and say, okay, we're going to go out and cut, you know, clear the streams and do all this stuff that we did at Smith & Hawken. It wouldn't have never worked there. It wasn't important to them, and it was important to the brand. So I think you've got to kind of pick and choose your battles a little bit.
Great, thank you guys. So building off of that, what did you learn when leading these different companies within the process that surprised you?
Everything. let me think about that one. I think there's a couple of things to say. I think most, and I was in retail, most retail businesses, and I would say most businesses have a great deal of overlap on what's important. You know, do you guys use Venn diagrams? You know what a Venn diagram is? Two circles, and in the middle there's a, you know, a spot where it overlaps. I think most businesses have a lot of similarities. They're not that different. What you have to overlay is the story I just told, the cultural values, what you're selling. You know, we bought a lot of stuff from China at Sur La Table, because by that point, the margins were, it was impossible to run a company not to. So, I mean, there's just, time makes you change things, but fundamentally, and it's the stuff that we'll probably wrap up with, there are some core things that are important at every single business. I mean, in the introduction, Dr. Lucy said I worked at Home Depot. That place is crazy. It's huge. Same problems I saw in little startups. So I'm not going to tell you the answer now, but I will at the end. There's a lot of similarities in business that I think if you work one place successfully, you can transfer that. You just have to be super sensitive to the culture and the people and the team and what you're selling and your marketing message and all that stuff. That's the fun part, the stuff that changes.
So what surprised me? One of the most surprising things was the value of creating culture. You don't realize you need it until you're kind of halfway down the road and everybody thinks differently about the business. And this is why that 4 D's process is so important. One of the exercises I've done with a lot of clients is to sit them down separately and answer those four questions. What makes you different? How do you defend that differentiation? And how are you disruptive? And you ask a bunch of executives at the same company those three questions, and they all have completely different answers. And so that's why messaging is so important, and that's why it helps to create a culture of consistency when it comes to telling a story. So always think about messaging at the very beginning of business and how a clear and concise messaging platform can create a specific culture around a brand.
Thank you.
So you mentioned culture, Michael, and I appreciate that you did, because I think now there's been so much emphasis towards culture, maybe more than there has been in the past. How do you think culture is born within a corporation? Where does it essentially come from? Is it leadership? Is it the employees that form that? Or is it kind of a cooperation within that that forms that culture?
The leaders of the corporation really are the ones that set the tone. And so, like I was saying before, you've got this whole concept around what's the message of the brand and what story are we telling. But then, you know, I came into the market, my former business partner and I had a very different viewpoint about community. Not that she didn't care about the community, but it wasn't as much of a focus as it was for me. You know, I'd give everything away if I could. Like, that's just my nature. I don't have to have a lot of things. But what I do want to have is I want to see a community thrive. And so just going into that business every single day and communicating that message in the everything that I do, not only what I say, but what we do. Like, we have this whole line of wines, and we give a dollar back to the Sonoma Land Trust and to the Guerneville School. So when our employees see that and they hear that, then they start telling that story, and it starts to make them think, wow, this is a really unique business that I'm a part of. I'm excited to play a role in this. So it comes from the top down pretty much always.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, when I was sort of working my way up through the Nature Company, I was in charge of all the stores. I was the vice president of retail, I think they called it at that point. And it was a horrible time to hire. You know, there was these cycles where right now, everybody's working who wants to work. It's a really hard time to hire good people. So you have to offer something else. And I think that's a lot of where culture comes in. And one of the things I did at the Nature Company is I wanted people who could talk to our customers in an intelligent way and knew their stuff. You know, we had it was a very complicated assortment of products. We had minerals. We had all kinds of crazy stuff, dinosaurs. You had to know stuff to really work there. So I let them start teaching classes in the stores. So we had this whole events program where they got to be the teachers, and they loved it. And you know what? I got the right kind of people in there, and the culture sort of shifted to where I wanted it. But I do have sort of a, I don't know if it's cynical or perhaps pragmatic comment about culture. It's a overused word, because really culture, like, is just people working together. I mean, you have some values at the top. We've both talked about, you know, the different values of Big Bottom and Sur-La-Table and Smith and Hagen, but it's not static. It's organic. It changes. Like, if we six started a business, and then Aiden said, hey, I got a better job, I'm going somewhere, the culture would shift. There would be somebody else sitting in his seat who had a different point of view, who would love something different. So I'm a big believer in, you have a value system, you have a vision, you have very clear ideas of where you're going, but the culture is alive, it's well, it shifts, it changes, and I think that makes it more fun. Bigger companies, you hear, you know, the culture at Google's terrible. Well, geez, how many employees do they have now versus when they started? You know, it's hard to manage culture through growth. And my theory is you let it be organic. You don't let it go off the tracks, but that's leadership. So yeah, leadership.
And I just want to jump in and say one other thing is I hope that all of you will go out and get a job and learn from other people, but don't run for the money. look inside the company and get a really clear understanding of how they treat their people and what the culture is all about. Because if you just run for the money, it doesn't feel really good when the people around you don't mesh with who you are as a professional.
So we do have quite a few seniors in our audience, and because you both mentioned that culture comes from top down, you're some of the people who do the hiring. What would you say is a very appealing feature in a candidate when you're looking?
Personality. And did you do your homework? Do you know who I am? Do you know what my brand is all about? Can you tell me a little bit about it without me having to ask you that question? And are you personable? You know, I mean, well, I'm in the customer service business, so if you can't talk to somebody, I don't want you in my store.
Right. I've done so much hiring in my life. I think you have to have a very practical side too. Like, if you're hiring somebody to work in a retail environment, you really want extroverts. I mean, introverts have very good skills, but not if you're supposed to go out and talk to everybody. It's very hard. So I think there is kind of a assessment of the personality, like Michael said, that is for a specific job really important to know what is the job and how are you going to be successful hiring this person to do it. But I agree. I mean, you want people that you want to see every day. You want to hire people that enhance the team, not, you know, detract from it. I had this one guy one time. I was desperate for an IT person, and it was one of those times when there was nobody around, and so I hired this guy, and I knew it was a mistake, but I just needed somebody to run the systems. And finally, after about 3 years, I went in and I said, "We're voting you off the island. You do not get it. I don't care what you do. I'll do it out for a while. I'll do it myself." So, I mean, you can't force, you know, unhappy people to be happy. You got to accept people at sort of face value. And I think happy people, people who are excited about what you're doing, there's all kinds of things that you should look for. But all you seniors, you're going out into a world that is great right now. So be picky. You can get a job.
Yeah, and also, in your interview, make sure you say, "I will do anything. Put any job in front of me, and I'm going to do it." Because I'll tell you, Google was my client for a while. And I mean, they have people that sharpen pencils at Google and develop like full strategies around how they're going to sharpen pencils. That's not true. But everybody is in a silo there. And nobody really steps out of their box. They have a job. They do that job. They go home. It's very rote. And if that's the kind of life you want, great. Go work at Google. It can be a fun company to work with. But when you're in an interview, you have to be willing to say, "I'm going to do just about anything I need to do to make sure that I prove to you I'm going to be the best person at this job."
Yeah, the worst three words to anybody is for an employee to say, "Ain't my job." And that's like, yeah, everything I say is your job.
Cool. Great questions, great answers. And now we're going to transition to the Q&A, take it out to the audience. But thank you to our panelists for being up here. And Dr. LePage, yeah.
We both thought the questions were really good when we got to screen them a little bit beforehand. You guys are thinking the right thoughts now, really thinking holistically about your business education.
Okay. So Manny's on that side of the audience, and I'll take care of this side of the audience, and we'd welcome questions, and you can direct it to either Michael or Kathy, or to both, and we'd expect about 10-15 minutes of questions, and if I don't see any, I'll just go to you. And so it's better to have volunteers. So who would like to ask a question? Yep, there's a question there. The next question's on this side.
Yeah, the other advice we have, ask a lot of questions.
That's right.
Because if you don't ask questions, you'll never get an answer.
Hi, thank you for today. I am currently a senior. I'm going into, you know, looking for jobs. I'm going into my MBA as well, but I think a problem that I and other of my classmates have had is like, how do you break through that paper? How do you break through the resume and the cover letter to be able to show you our personality and show you who we are? I think that's the hardest part for me is like, when I know I get that FaceTime, like I can do a good job, but I don't know how to make that personality shine through on a piece of paper, on that resume, and on that cover letter.
Yeah, no, go.
So I was those four D's that I talked about. You don't only have to apply that to a business; you can apply that to yourself. What makes me different, you know, and how do I defend that, like? How do I say I'm really different and this is why I'm really different? And these are some of the interesting, disruptive things that I've done throughout college or, you know, the other thing that I think is really important is looking at the jobs that you've had. So maybe you worked at McDonald's and you think that that's not worth talking about, but maybe you learned something working at McDonald's. You know, that's a real corporate environment and they educate people really well there, or Starbucks or whatever. Always look for the things in the jobs that you've had and be able to communicate how that will translate into the next job you're going to have. To be able to show someone that you think like that is really powerful.
Yeah, and I think you said it earlier, you got to do your homework too. You cannot go into a job interview thinking that I got it. You've really got it. And I think asking them perceptive questions is always a really good idea. Storytelling. I mean, I think Michael said it. You've got to present yourself as somebody who is interesting and had things that they've done outside of work. I mean, you know, I've done a lot. You guys saw my bio, whatever. The three things people ask me all the time, tell me about the Peace Corps. Tell me about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, you know? You're going to have a pretty level playing ground. You got to sort of shove yourself a little bit above the ordinary, I think. And so if you've done anything that's interesting, make sure that gets woven into the conversation, because that stuff is that's your story.
How about a question on this side? Ryan, how about you?
So this one's directed to the entrepreneur. When you met Oprah's PR person, is that right? How were you able to scale your business? I think that we're maybe working for a small company. You hope to grow it into something large and something prosperous. What are some things that you could tell a young maybe entrepreneur, someone working for a startup, that they could do to help their company grow?
Wake up every morning and say, yes, I can. And that was what we did. We said when Oprah called, it wasn't Oprah that called, I wish it was, but when Oprah's people called and said, you're one of Oprah's favorite things, you probably have to have at least 8,000 to 10,000 products available for sale of each of our products. So we had a honey and a biscuit mix. And so I sat down with the team and I said, this is going to be hard, but you're going to wake up every single morning and we're going to say, yes, we can. We had 6 weeks to get to 8,000 products to Amazon, and we just kept pushing. We figured out how we were going to do it. So, you know, you have to be able to say, I can do this no matter what. And I said this before, which is why I hope that next time they say, who wants to ask a question, we see a lot more hands, is that if you don't ask the question, you're never gonna get an answer. And that's a really important thing, is being curious. Kathy talked about it before. You have to be really curious, so.
I think going off of that, I think, yeah, waking up every day and doing the best you can is kind of something that you would have to do. But what does that mean in more detail? Like, is it long hours? Are you compromising possibly the quality that's going to the work? I know you don't want to ever do that, but what happens when you have to scale it that rapidly? How do you do that effectively, just in a little bit more detail.
Well, you have to push everything aside. You know, I mean, I had to say, hey, mom and dad, I won't be home for Christmas until like Christmas Day. We have a lot that's going into making this happen. So I had to make some sacrifices. And as an entrepreneur, you're constantly making sacrifices. So that's probably one of the biggest things we had to do. And we also had to be creative, you know? So you wake up every morning, you say, yes, I can, but how am I gonna do that? You know, I can, I will, I do, I am. I say that all the time. Like, I'm always presented with these challenges, and the immediately thing I say in my head, I can, I will, I do, I am. And I use each of those phrases to try to figure out, how am I gonna answer the next big question that comes down the pike? I also really encourage every single entrepreneur that, you know, growth is a challenge, and Kathy has helped me with growth. She's helped me better understand. And so I talked before about finding mentors. Find as many mentors as you can, because there are people super smart that have done it before, and you might as well do your best to learn from those people. And I'll tell you, when I was in my first job, everyone called me a brown noser. They were like, oh, you're nosing up to the VP of marketing, or nosing up to the CMO, nosing up to the head of the company. And I was doing it because I wanted to learn from those people. I wasn't trying to be a brown noser. I was trying to get smart. And so, all of those people taught me so many things, and I wake up with those every morning, knowing that I have that knowledge carried with me that I learned from other people. So find yourself a mentor as quickly as possible.
You know, one of the things I've completely changed my mind on, and I don't know if it's how my age or the times or whatever, but I used to pride myself on being a multitasker. I could do 10 things at once. And I tended to hire people like that. And now I think it's all about focus. Honestly, I think you gotta set your goals that you can achieve rather than just having things come at you all day. You know, when I was hiking all those ways, all those days by myself in the Himalayas, I realized I'd sort of forgotten how to think. I could react. I was so good at reacting. I could deal with anything that came at me, but so much about being a leader, and I hope all of you want to be leaders of some sort, it's really about thinking and using your brains to solve problems, not just reacting. So it's something I learned the hard way, but I think for you all who are living in the complete age of distraction and overwhelming, you know, information, you've got to focus on what really you want to get done that day, that moment, that time. And I used to think multitasking was a secret. I totally don't think that works for almost anybody anymore.
Thank you.
Hi. So. So you guys mentioned multi-channeling. Was that the term?
Multi-channel.
Multi-channel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was looking over here. I was like, I can't.
So how would you sustain that as a business without spreading yourself too thin?
Yeah. Well, the other thing I would tell you right now is, besides, you know, hiring great people, you got to learn to delegate. You cannot do all this stuff yourself. And certainly when you're in a business that's complex and has various moving parts, all requiring different skills, gets back to hiring really good people and trusting them to do, you know, to run that part of the business. And you learn stuff all along the way. I mean, I mentioned we had these cooking schools at Sur La Table, and when I went there, everybody was like, oh, the cooking schools. I go, we're not going to talk about the cooking schools. That's a nice to do, but we're not talking about that yet until we get the business fixed. And so, and they were losing money like everything else. And so finally, I had enough confidence that things were sort of working. And we went and we examined the cooking schools. And somebody who was working in the stores came up with this great idea, and it changed the profitability overnight. So I could finally listen to the ideas that were there, but they were out in the field. They weren't in the main office. And I think, you know, I was really privileged to go to Harvard as an executive, which if you ever get the chance, go. And they taught us, I mean, they only teach you a few things there. It's all case studies. And they said, figure out who in the organization can make the best decision. And I never forgot that. It's not always the vice president of marketing or, you know, the person that's sitting next to you. You've got to really balance how you delegate when you're doing a multiple business. And it's not easy, but I don't think you can be in retail anymore without being on the web. And a lot of companies start on the internet now and add stores later. So you've got lots of opportunities.
I just learned a lesson about delegation the other day, and I try to teach myself new things all the time. And I have the person that runs the market for us on a daily basis. She's awesome, but she's what I call a no person, and I'm a yes person. And for the longest time, I kept thinking, she's a no person, and I have to make her be a yes person. I want her to say yes when I go to her and say, I want to do this. Instead of saying to me, yes, that's a great idea, let's do it, she would come to me and say, no, 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 no. And ultimately, we'd get to the same place, but I would get so mad at her because I had been delegating something to her, and she wasn't listening to me, but what I wasn't doing was listening to her. And what she was trying to tell me was, I'm thinking about all the things that could potentially go wrong before we figure out how to make it right, because those things matter too. So this was last week. I like had this epiphany where I'm like, God, I gotta let her think the way that she thinks. I can't make her think the way that I think. So, you know, if you're gonna be multi-channel, you gotta let people run that channel that you've asked them to run the way that they're gonna run it. You trusted them enough to hire them, let them do their job.
Right. And I have to say, when I was really young and, you know, raising my hand to do everything and multitasking, I was really bad at listening. And my boss told me that every review. And now I'm really good at listening. And I think it's a skill. The sooner you can develop the skill of truly listening to what's being said to you, it just helps so much. And I don't know how, I can barely survive just all the stuff that comes at me. And I can only imagine all the things you have to deal with on a daily basis just to get through life. And I think listening is really gonna be one of those critical skills. And the other thing, I believe, and I was teaching this class at USF, and they were really hardcore, MBA, the end, they were graduating, and they said, well, you talk a lot about the softer side of business and, you know, empathy and listening. And I go, yeah, because it really matters. You cannot just go out there thinking you know everything because you have an MBA. You really have to have those personal skills, and I think that's one of the things that we help each other on, you know. Michael just had some bad news. He called me up. I said, don't overreact. This is just business. It's just business.
But it sucked.
It was terrible, but it was. So I calmed him down, and he kind of connected to something and focused and listened and went on with it. So, yeah, I think the softer side of things is really important for you to know as well. So I'm a big proponent of empathy, listening, teamwork, all those things I think are really mission critical.
There's a question, one more probably.
Yeah. 6:59, Fran.
I first want to say thank you so much for coming and sharing your story and your professional careers. I'm Catalina. I'm a freshman business major. And the question that I have for you both, I think Michael touched on it a little bit, but what was your first job and what skills did you learn, and how did that kind of pave your, I guess, professional or maybe career journey?
Go.
My first job was working for my dad, you know, which was really was hard because he was my boss. And I decided that I didn't want to work for him anymore. And I went to him and told him this. And he said, you know, I'm going to be really disappointed if you don't work for me anymore. And I was like, ugh, the D word. It's the worst thing in the world. But what I learned in that experience, he was trying to teach me a lesson. And the lesson he was trying to teach me was, do you really want to be a construction worker? Because that was the option in our family. You know, do you want to work on heavy construction and move from being a laborer to a project manager to working in the office and estimating? And he put me at the hardest job that I could do so I could figure out if I really wanted to pursue a career in that. So having my dad as my first boss was one of the best things that could have ever happened to me, because he was purposefully teaching me a lesson without me realizing it. Now that I'm older, I look back and I go, oh, that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Now it all makes sense.
And my first job, which I think was the best thing I ever did in my life, was in the Peace Corps. You know, living in a foreign country, trying to help a village of people move the education systems forward, I was challenged in ways I'd never, ever thought I could handle. And I think that's where I learned to be a leader. I made decisions. I helped people. I pulled every trick out of the book. I mean, I was 22 years old. I mean, some of you guys are 22, but I was really unsophisticated at 22, let me tell you. So I think that, you know, you learn, there's something you learn from the best jobs and the worst jobs. And I think I was really fortunate to probably have one of the best jobs of my life, you know, teaching in Fiji. For 2 years, I learned so much that I use all the day, every day, to apply to other things. So I encourage you to go out and live. Don't just study. Life is really there for you. And I think you're going to take those skills that you learn outside of school and outside of work, and that's going to make you a more interesting and better person, and you're going to get the job you want.
Thank you.
So we got
you
some...
You wanted...
Yeah, we
time.
Want to go back yep. to sort yep. of the beginning. So
okay.
how, when I asked you those questions about, do you think you know the skills to be an entrepreneur when we started? What do you think now? Real entrepreneur. Do you have the skills? Are you excited? No, you're tired. You're hungry.
Yeah. And I'd also ask you the really important question. Are you willing to be scared? And are you willing to do what I call failing forward? That, to me, is the most important thing that every entrepreneur has to be able to do. Failure isn't a bad thing. It's like this big red flag going, hey, you're going down the wrong road. I need you to turn left. You got to learn from failure, because it's awesome when it happens, because I get so much insight out of it. So be willing to be afraid and be willing to fail.
Well, I think there's three things that I always stress with students and people in business. And I've worked in so many businesses that have been successful and also many that have failed. And they all fail for the same reason, and they're all successful for the same reason. And there are three things that are absolutely important that you learn. Number one is communication. We are people. If you do not communicate, you will never be successful. Number two is teamwork. You've got to learn to work well with other people, people unlike yourself. People, like when I was growing up, you guys didn't ask me about being a woman, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I had a whole chapter in this book I was writing that goes, play well with boys. The boys made all the rules, so I had to figure out how to play well in that environment. But that's teamwork. And the last thing is execution. We can talk culture and empathy and all these things, but if you don't execute, and I think that's what Michael is saying on his entrepreneurial level, and I'm saying as a leader, so what? It's a great idea, but you're not going to really be successful. So I wish you all well. It's been so much fun to talk to you, and we'll hang around a little bit and eat cookies with you.
So I'm sure all of you, join me in thanking Kathy and Michael for really sharing their mind with us. You had an opportunity tonight to hear two entrepreneurs listen to their wisdom, their experiences, and share in their thinking. It's a very unusual experience to have people like that so willing to, number one, give of their time. They're extremely busy people, and yet they're here with you. So that should be a lesson to you to appreciate each other and also appreciate Michael and Kathy for spending their time with you. I'd also like to say a few thank yous for the production team, which includes Yvonne, Corey, and Emily. They did a wonderful job. And as Kathy says, a lot of communication went on as this was organized. And so we thank the team and also the panelists of Aiden, Olga, Marissa, and Dylan, who I think did a great job, and it was really wonderful. And also the podcast people, thanks to Stuart Horn and your team. We really appreciate what you've done. And also a reminder from Dr. Lucy, which we always give her reminders. BizBash is on April 25th, not on May 2nd. So there was a rumor that May 2nd was the date. If you look at your syllabi, freshmen and sophomore have it correct. It's April 25th. I think there was some miscommunication for the juniors and seniors. So we all want to be on the same page. So again, please join me in thanking them, and you have time to network with them.